As you travel home from Thanksgiving or scan the internet to plan your next vacation, we have a cautionary tale for you. It comes from someone who should have known better. Catherine Hamm is the travel editor for the Los Angeles Times. She was planning her wedding for May of last year in Oahu when she got scammed. Catherine Hamm, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
And you write in your article in the LA Times, "I always assumed that people who got scammed were knuckleheads. Now I know they are people just like me." What happened?
I had contracted to rent a place on Oahu, very close to my childhood home, so I was very excited about it. And about 6 days before the wedding, we realized that the place did not exist. What I had done was really stupid, and it was that I had wired money, had not used a credit card, because the person who rented this to me said, "Time is short, so we must have cash from you." And that was a huge mistake.
And you were scrambling because your original venue had fallen through. You needed to find something quick.
Right. So we were in a bind anyway. And besides her sense of urgency, there was my sense of urgency. It was sort of like the perfect storm.
When you booked this house, the supposed house for your wedding, how much money did you wire to this woman?
$4,750.
And it's gone.
It is gone.
So you go on your honeymoon, you come back, and at some point you start trying to figure out who it was who had perpetrated this fraud on you, and you found the person. She has quite a story, quite a biography. Tell us about it.
The person who is alleged to have done this, in many ways I admire her. She has done many different things, and she's also incredibly bright. She had gone to Scotland on a vacation, had met a British aristocrat, and they had married some months later. That marriage didn't last, and she came back to the United States, married a fellow up in Seattle, did some charity work, amazingly enough. But she allegedly has a sideline business in which she rents rental houses for vacation venues that are simply not hers to rent.
You name the woman in the article as Amanda Movius, that's her maiden name, and you, through internet searches, find other of her alleged victims. What did they tell you about her?
Essentially much of the same thing that I already knew about her, that she was very charming, she came across as very confident, that all of the arrangements seemed very professional, that she seemed like she was on the up and up. Of course, then they at some point realized that there was no house, or if there was a house, it was not hers to rent.
You also were able to track down Amanda's family members. You talked to her father in Fairbanks, Alaska, and it turns out she has a really tragic family story behind her.
She lost her mother at a very young age. Her mom had some addiction issues and died when Amanda was just in high school. And Fairbanks in those days was kind of a rowdy place. So it was kind of an interesting combination of factors.
And her brother told you, "I know she struggles and I know she suffers, and I want her to find her way to help."
Her brother and her sister and her father, I have to say, were extremely cooperative in the course of this story. They're all very articulate, and they love her because she is family, but they also realize that there are some issues there, issues that they don't have. And so it's the unconditional love of a family, yet tempered with the knowledge that perhaps there are some issues there that need to be dealt with.
Where is the woman whom you came to know as Amanda Movius? Where is she now?
She is in jail in Travis County, Texas. That's Austin, and that's where the charges are pending against her.
And what are those charges?
There are three that have to do with renting houses that either did not exist or were not hers to rent. The others have nothing to do with that. They have to do with identity fraud. My case, however, is in Smith County, Texas, in Tyler, Texas. The money that I wired was sent to a bank in Tyler, Texas.
At the end of your story in the LA Times, you write that sometimes you do feel sorry for Amanda.
One of the things that I learned during all of this was that if I continue to be angry, the person that hurts is me, not Amanda. And really, somebody who does this, and I have to say that what happened to me was really very annoying, because it was a wedding. I was excited. I was a middle-aged bride. It was my first time. I was sort of breathless. And I think, how could somebody be that mean? And then I realized, you know, somebody who does that is really not the object of scorn. Maybe she's the object of pity.
Catherine Hamm, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Catherine Hamm is the travel editor for the Los Angeles Times. For more than 50 years, announcer Bob Shepard has been the iconic voice of Yankee Stadium.
Number two, Derek Jeter, shortstop.
Bob Shepard has missed the last two Yankee seasons because of illness. And yesterday, the website for Major League Baseball ran a story saying that Shepard has decided it is time to officially cede control of his microphone to a successor. My heart sank when I read that. I met Bob Shepard back in 1996 when I went to Yankee Stadium to do a profile of him. I count myself among the millions of devoted Bob Shepard fans. And I've been holding out hope that he will be back in that announce booth, his majestic voice resonating through the new Yankee Stadium. So I called his house today and spoke with his wife, Mary. She told me that there is nothing official, that nothing has been announced yet, and that Bob has been working to regain his strength. And I asked her about something else. When I interviewed Bob Shepard way back in 1996, I asked him what I thought was a basic question.
Can I ask how old you are?
No.
I can ask.
No.
You don't have to answer.
No. I'm on the shady side of middle age, and that is the answer that I would be willing to have you put on tape and keep there. The shady side of middle age. And if that isn't enough for you, then this interview is over.
So given that sensitivity, imagine my surprise to read on MLB.com that Bob Shepard is talking openly now about being 99 years old. 99 years, he said. Wow, can you envision that? His wife, Mary, told me that she had always encouraged him to reveal his age, that anyone could Google it anyway, but that he wanted to keep that to himself until recently. So, Bob Shepard, I'm rooting for you to be in Yankee Stadium late next October at age 100 for another World Series. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. When Raymond Carver died in 1988, the Times of London dubbed him the American Chekhov. Carver is still considered one of the greatest modern short story writers. Now there's a new, nearly 600-page biography called Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life. Author Susan Jane Gilman has this review.
Confession. The first time I read a Raymond Carver story, I didn't get it. It was so spare, so lacking epiphany, I thought, huh? But then I read his story, A Small Good Thing, and Cathedral, and Neighbors. I read his collection, Where I'm Calling From, and then I got it. Carver's stories are unadorned tales of ordinary people. Their very simplicity and elegance pack a deep emotional punch. This is why Carver's often extolled as a master of minimalism. Which is ironic, because according to Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life by Carol Sklenica, Carver's own life wasn't minimalist at all. It was stunningly chaotic. Ray, as he was known, was like many of the characters he wrote about. A working-class boy in Yakima, Washington, he married his sweetheart, Marianne Burke, at age 19. They had two children in less than 2 years and lived hand to mouth. Marianne often waitressed and juggled jobs so Ray could write. And they moved around a lot. Until he was 41, Carver never held down a job for more than 18 months. The only constant was his writing. Rejection slips mounted, but he started to publish. He and Marianne drank and fought violently, though, and their lives spun out of control. Twice they filed for bankruptcy. At least once Ray almost landed in jail, and at least once Marianne was rushed to the emergency room after Ray beat her. Unlike many famous writers, however, Carver managed to stop drinking. Although he died at age 50 in 1988, in the last decade of his life, he achieved sobriety. With this came unprecedented literary success and a redemptive love with the poet Tess Gallagher. His own story ended with a measure of grace. Given this, it would be easy for Sklenica to write a dishy, sensational bio or a hagiography. Thankfully, she does neither. Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, is a sober, sensitive portrait of an often drunken and complex man. Sklenica clearly adores Carver's work, but does a fine job of portraying his poignant contradictions. He's funny and abusive, insecure and dogged, nervous and passionate. She's careful to distinguish the man from his writing. Even when she draws parallels between his life and his fiction, it's to illuminate his creative process. Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, is an honest portrait of a man's messy, triumphant literary struggle. It neither condemns nor exonerates him. In this way, the book is an ultimate tribute to Carver. As a writer, he was, after all, revered for being both unflinching and tender. And Sklenica's biography is exactly this, unflinching and tender. It is a big, good thing.
Susan Jane Gilman reviewing the new biography, Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, by Carol Sklenica. Gilman's latest book is a memoir called Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. The nation's largest ports have become toxic hotspots in violation of federal clean air standards. The pollution comes from the combination of ships and thousands of idling diesel trucks at ports such as Newark, Los Angeles, and Oakland. There's broad agreement that the solution is newer, cleaner trucks, but as Nancy Solomon reports, there's one hitch. Who pays?
Most of the televisions, computers, and other gadgets that clutter American homes arrive at a port and are picked up by some of the oldest trucks on the road. At the port of Newark, which serves the greater New York area, tractor trailers line up for hours, and the air is thick with exhaust fumes and soot. As the drivers wait to pick up a load, I ask them the age of their trucks.
97.
She's 9 years old.
10 years.
2000.
Can you afford a new one with the new clean trucks program?
No. I'm hardly making payroll with this one here. No way.
That's Edwidge Tiafall. And like most of the truck drivers at ports, he's called an independent owner-operator. Since deregulation of the trucking industry in 1980, most port trucking companies no longer hire drivers, but contract with independents who pay for all the expenses to run their trucks.
You know, this is a place where old trucks go to die.
Fred Potter, director of the Ports Division for the Teamsters Union, says a new truck costs about $100,000. Even with the help of grants and low-cost financing offered by ports, Potter says that's out of reach for these drivers, who make, on average, $28,000 a year.
What these owner-operators can afford are trucks $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, even $25,000. That's older, is more polluting than new technology. And then they try to keep these trucks together and working for as long as they're making these payments.
The Teamsters are part of a growing green-blue alliance, working with environmentalists to require port trucking companies to hire drivers and buy new fleets, what's called a clean trucks program. Potter says it's part of a growing willingness among unions to see the future of stable, good-paying jobs as inextricably linked to a green economy. Curtis Whalen of the American Trucking Association, the trade group representing the companies, scoffs at this idea.
They wrapped it into a clean air concept, but in fact this was a business model attack to allow them to then all of a sudden find a whole new target for unionization being the port driver.
Whalen says most drivers want to be independent and that the bulk of trucking companies are small and can't afford new fleets either. The Trucking Association has sued the Los Angeles port, arguing that federal interstate commerce rules supersede local restrictions. They want an injunction that allows companies to continue using contract labor until the matter's resolved in court. This frustrates folks in the neighborhood closest to the Port of Newark.
We're standing at what's called the foot of Hawkins Street, where our local elementary school, Hawkins Street School, is located.
Ana Baptista of the Ironbound Community Corporation has counted as many as 100 trucks go down this street in an hour. She believes the truck traffic is why 1 in 4 kids in Newark has asthma, compared to 1 in 12 in nearby suburbs. The suitably named Ironbound is a working-class immigrant community sandwiched between a huge international airport, the country's busiest rail line, and its third-largest port.
You know, when you ask people in Newark what their biggest issue is, a lot of them will tell you jobs. You know, the environment is really important, my kids' health is really important, but I need a job.
Mayors Cory Booker of Newark, Michael Bloomberg of New York, and Antonio Villaraigosa of L.A. favor the dual goals of greening the ports and providing better-paying jobs for locals. If the Trucking Association wins its lawsuit, the Green-Blue Alliance and its influential mayors say they'll fight to change the federal rules so that each port can set its own standards on just how companies haul goods out of the shipping terminals. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Some people in Hawaii are watching the national healthcare debate with a been-there-done-that attitude. Hawaii has one of the country's lowest percentages of uninsured residents. It passed its own healthcare redesign 35 years ago. From Hawaii Public Radio, Ben Marcus reports.
Longtime Hawaii Congressman Neil Abercrombie wants to be clear. Hawaii is not trying to exempt itself from efforts to overhaul healthcare. But
should the happy circumstance take place that the national bill is better than ours, offers more benefits, and is more reasonably priced and available than ours, well, then, of course, we'll rescind ours.
Hawaii was the first state to attempt universal coverage. It did it by instituting an employer mandate. In other words, all businesses, big and small, must provide health insurance for employees who've worked more than 20 hours a week. These days, only about 8% of Hawaii's population is uninsured. That's half the national average and way ahead of states like Texas with 25% uninsured. Congressman Abercrombie is joined in the fight by the rest of the state's long-term and subsequently powerful delegation. They've inserted explicit language protecting Hawaii's system in both the House and Senate versions of national health care overhaul.
I certainly wouldn't want to question that wisdom.
That's Jeannie Pressler. She's a high-ranking hospital executive and an advocate for Hawaii's uninsured. Pressler's been an influential voice in the Hawaii healthcare debate for many years. She says there's a lot worth protecting.
We do have good health care and access to health care and the lowest cost per enrollee in Medicare anywhere in the nation. And again, for our commercial payers, we have the second lowest premiums anywhere in the nation.
Still, Pressler says Hawaii's not immune to the growing cost of health care, a burden that forces some companies to find ways around the mandate. Here at the Waikiki Health Center, it's a busy morning. The center caters to low-income and homeless patients. Through this recession, it's seen a tenfold increase in workload as the newly jobless lose their employer-provided insurance. Waiting in line is Jason Sampson. He was recently laid off from a local detail shop. To get treatment, he must first sit down with Gary Gorman, an eligibility coordinator. Sampson tells her that despite working full-time, he didn't get insurance.
Okay, so they never offered any kind of health insurance at all?
They told me after 30 days that I would be getting it, but I never got no health card, insurance card, anything like that. And they never took it out of none of my paychecks.
The health center says they see a lot of this, companies withholding insurance against state law. They also hear of employers scaling back hours to avoid the mandate. Sam Sloan is a small businessman and a Republican state senator. He says the mandate has put Hawaii companies who follow the rules at a disadvantage, probably forcing some out of business altogether.
And you know, anecdotally, you can tell stories about that, but somebody says, well, show me where it actually happened. And that's really hard to do.
It's hard to do because the employer mandate, as he sees it, is just one of many onerous mandates, taxes, and regulations in Hawaii. Other businesses see the mandate as a benefit. At Murphy's Bar and Grill in downtown Honolulu, owner Don Murphy says he provides health insurance not just for individual employees, but in some cases their whole family.
So, you know, you want to help them out. I mean, that's, you know, when you do that, hopefully they stay. And, you know, I've got, God, I don't know, my average employee's probably been here over 10 years. So I've got a couple guys that have been with me since I opened. It's 22 years.
Though he readily admits the rising cost of that benefit is eating into the bottom line. Jerry Russo, a health economist at the University of Hawaii, doesn't discount the mandate's impact on businesses. In the face of skyrocketing insurance premiums, he says Hawaii employers are unable to drop coverage.
And we've seen that on the U.S. mainland, that a lot of employers have dropped coverage, whereas in Hawaii it's continued to be stable. Now, that may have been a hardship for the employers. We don't really know.
Whether or not the mandate is a hardship on businesses, Russo believes it's quite amazing that a system designed 35 years ago still provides widespread coverage today. And it looks like that system may continue for decades to come. Protection for Hawaii's employer mandate is still alive in both the House and Senate versions of healthcare overhaul. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.